Good morning. Sweaty palms, if you were hoping to fly away with Aer Lingus next week, keep an eye on your inbox.
It's like waking up and wondering if you've got a phone call from your ex-boyfriend. I don't want to hear from Aer Lingus for the next week. I don't want to. I mean, obviously, if my flight has been cancelled or rescheduled, I do want to hear from them. But you open your email with trepidation, hoping there isn't an email from them there. But you have to be a bit philosophical about this as well, Sarah. And there's nothing I can do. I don't think Aer Lingus or IALPA are going to change the rules just for little old me.
Cleann O'Flynn, a journalist based in Tenerife, speaking to Sarah on Wednesday's Drive Time. And from next Wednesday, pilots with Aer Lingus will start an indefinite work to rule as they look for better pay and conditions. And at least 24 flights per day will be cancelled by Aer Lingus from Wednesday to Sunday next week. On Morning Ireland yesterday, Donal Moriarty, Chief Corporate Affairs Officer with Aer Lingus, had this to say.
The particular problem with this strict form of work to rule is that it is cumulative. It gets worse day by day as the rostering becomes less efficient. And therefore, there is the risk that an increasing level of cancellation is going to be required. We're obviously keen to avoid that. We would like to engage in direct discussions with IALPA to reach a reasonable settlement to this pay dispute.
Also on Morning Ireland, the president of the Irish Airline Pilots Association, IALPA, Mark Tighe.
We've been in talks effectively for 22 months on this, and they still insist that pilots pay for their pay increase over and above anything else that anybody else got themselves. So they can fix this. They can come to their senses and see the reasonability of our cumulative pay claim.
But on Thursday, reports that Aer Lingus would be making a few calls to free up staff and planes. Work and technology correspondent Brian O'Donovan joined Claire.
Will that, Brian, result in the dispute becoming even more entrenched?
It could do, because what we're going to see now is Aer Lingus reaching out to everybody. They're going to reach out to their partner airlines. Remember, they're part of this huge group, IAG, with Vueling, Iberia and British Airways. So they will certainly be reaching out to their friends. They'll also be reaching out to their enemies. They'll be going to their arch rivals, Ryanair, and seeing what they can do to accommodate people. And they have said that. They will say, look, we will do whatever it takes to reaccommodate people as best we can. But as I mentioned earlier, worst time of the year for that, Claire, because all those other planes are going to be booked by those airlines. So it's going to be really, really difficult. And yes, they will look to hire in external crews. They will look to hire in external aircraft, but they're also all booked. So of course, and this is why IALPA are doing it at this time of year, it is designed to create maximum disruption. So it's going to be a very difficult picture. Aer Lingus saying, look, the best thing you can do right now is go on to the homepage. And when you go on to the Aer Lingus homepage, there's a big orange banner across the top saying travel advisory. Click into that. That will have the most up-to-date information. Also, what you'll get there, though, is the information for passengers in terms of their rights when it comes to refunds, reaccommodation. And the advice for passengers right now, who absolutely must be extremely nervous, particularly if they're flying next Wednesday, is don't cancel your flight, because then you're effectively letting Aer Lingus off the hook and you won't get the rebooking, you won't get the reaccommodation, you won't get the compensation that you would if they were to cancel your flight. And remember, your flight may not be cancelled. Flights will be operating, but there will be some cancellations and there will be disruption. And a disruption, Claire, that will build and build and build for as long as this work to rule goes on.
And all of this before an announcement yesterday evening that Aer Lingus IALPA pilots will take part in an 8-hour strike on June 29th. A story, no doubt, we will be back to. Now, on Thursday, a serving soldier who beat a woman unconscious in a random street attack and boasted about it on social media walked free from court after being given a fully suspended sentence, which the victim described as not justice. Cathal Crotty, 22, of Ard na Chruiche, County Clare, had initially tried to blame the victim, 24-year-old Natasha O'Brien, by wrongly telling Gardaí, who arrested him, that she had instigated the attack. On Drive Time yesterday, Natasha O'Brien spoke to Cormac and he started the interview by asking her what had happened that night.
Yeah, so I was on my way home from work with my friend and we were walking up to get a taxi home together. We noticed this group of males in front of us. They were shouting across the street at a young lone male, quite homophobic slurs. They seemed very aggressive and we were just kind of minding our own business. But then, you know, we were filtering through them and we just politely and nonchalantly kind of, ah, lads, come on now, don't be calling anyone, you know. And yeah, it was just met with extreme aggression. And before I knew it, I was getting held by the head of hair. It held like a punching bag, just being punched repeatedly into the face. I literally didn't even feel human. And yeah, I ended up hitting my head off the ground. My friend was screaming for help. As she was screaming for help, a lovely male ran down to rescue, pulled him off me while I was unconscious because he wasn't stopping.
Did you plead with Cathal to stop?
I did. I was on the ground. I remember saying, please stop. And, you know, the last thing I remember, as I was losing consciousness, I just remember thinking, he's not stopping. He's going to kill me. I just really feared for my life in that moment. And had it not been for the male passerby that intervened, I may not be here today.
And she outlined the injuries she had sustained.
My physical injuries were absolutely devastating. Like, I had a severe concussion, a broken nose, as well as severe swelling and bruising on both arms, shoulders, head, right hip, left eye, just my swollen jaw. You know, I spent the following weeks in and out of hospitals and doctor's appointments, just, you know. And then due to serious persisting concussion, I actually was deemed high risk for a brain bleed and got a bit of a scare. And about a month later, so I had to go get a head CT scan and a battery of tests. And, you know, it was a pretty frightening time. Like, I wasn't sure how, I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, concussion, like, I think it lasted for up to three, about, yeah, sorry, the concussion lasted for about 3 months. You know, I was just blacking out, getting blackout spells, nausea, just.
Mentally,
yeah,
then,
of course.
How did it impact you psychologically?
Mentally. Yeah, psychologically, this is the issue though. The physical scars, they go away. Sometimes they go away in some cases, but usually the mental doesn't. The psychological, you know, it left me in a place of darkness. And I've been suffering with symptoms of PTSD. Have had to attend multiple therapists since the attack. There's just a sense of constant dread and isolation. It was like unlike anything I'd ever experienced. And I just ended up spiraling into self-destructive behaviors. I lost all interest and motivation for life. Just even basic tasks at work, it just became incredibly difficult. And I loved my job. And,
really?
You know.
And you never felt like that before. What do you mean, or can I ask you, about the self-destructive behaviours?
Barely able to put one foot in front of the other and just constantly not dealing with reality. I wasn't able to cope with reality. And so I would do whatever I could to just avoid my reality. And whether that was staying in bed for days or that was getting a bottle of wine, you know, it was just, I just didn't really want to even think about what would happen, but I almost couldn't avoid the flashbacks and the thinking about it. But I just did anything I could to just dissociate completely.
And Cormac asked her about the importance to her of her victim impact statement.
That's when it all started to, I brought it all up and I really had to relive it because I knew that the judge needed to hear the impact it had on me. I mean, I had to really open up all those feelings that I've been trying to box away and all those memories that, you know, I've blacked out, and they just come up. And, you know, I felt the need to speak up and take a stand against violence, essentially, because I am reading headlines all the time, and headline after headline, violent convicted walks away, suspended sentence, violent convictions, walks away, you know, and innocent, vulnerable, non-provoked. It's all these words, you know, and it's just constant. And I just said, they just don't, like, maybe the victims aren't explaining how hard it is, but I have to.
And going to court was an experience she described as terrifying.
How was it then to go to court with your very difficult story, having the impact it had on you, to walk past your attacker? What was that like, and in court and give your story?
I mean, I wasn't sitting in the car before I went into the courthouse itself that morning, and I couldn't get out of the car for about 15 minutes. I was just frozen. Like, every male of similar stature to the person that attacked me, I was like, oh my God, is it him? I just was like, oh, I just couldn't believe how much I felt like that punching bag all over again, you know?
How did you feel when you saw him in court?
I, yeah, it was just, I don't even have words. It was just, I couldn't even look. It was terrifying.
Carl Quatty received a 3-year sentence, which was suspended in its entirety. He was also ordered to pay €3,000 compensation to Natasha O'Brien without prejudice to any potential civil court proceedings.
I don't feel that I received any justice, and I don't feel that the Irish public have, the citizens of Ireland have received justice. I think it's really, really let down victims in the system of justice.
Yeah, I mean, you were there. You heard the judge say that he was, his fear that if he imposed a custodial sentence, that it may have repercussions for Mr. Crotty's job. He said he had to take into account that he had no previous convictions and his army career and so on. I mean, what do you feel when you hear that?
I have to bite my tongue. I thought, like, why on earth would you be worried about interfering with a future career when the career is a soldier that pledges to protect citizens of Ireland? That was just, that was what gave me that outrage, you know, it's really, really shocking.
And this was Cormac's final question to Natasha O'Brien.
If you could sum up then, if you had a message generally for people listening or anyone listening about the attack and your experience in the judicial system, what is that message?
I think I'm not speaking up because I'm upset that I didn't get my justice. You know, that's really not what my anger is about, that why I'm upset. I'm really upset that I watch all these headlines and all the victims, they're anonymous to me, or, you know, I don't know them. And I just see all these different headlines and it's like constant convicted walks free. And it's just, it's really frightening to be as a member of our nation, to be walking around knowing that these people are not reprimanded when they cause harm to others. You know, there's no real consequence, I don't feel. I think I'm just so afraid of the message that this sends, that it's okay to do this because, you know, you just have to behave for a year or two. That's all. That's the problem, the message that this sends.
Okay. Well, Natasha O'Brien, thank you so much indeed for talking to us on Drive Time. Can I say I'm really, really sorry that this happened to you at all. And I really wish you well.
Thank you so much, Cormac, for having me.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Just where are you getting your news? Do you have the dial super glued to the national broadcaster, or are you scrolling on TikTok? Surely not. But if it is, you are now in the majority. According to the Reuters Digital News Report Ireland 2024, online outlets are now the main source of news. Professor Colleen Morell from DCU's Institute of Future Media, Democracy and Society spoke to Keen on Morning Ireland.
There is evidence of real concern about what is real or what's fake online, with the number of people expressing concern up 7 points since 2023. That's now at 71% concerned about misinformation, disinformation, fake news. What were people telling you in this report?
Well, basically, the numbers have been going up for some time now in terms of people worried about what's out there. And that also includes things like the growth of AI that's coming around the corner. People are very unsure, for example, and they aren't happy with most news being done by AI, but also, you know, with just a little bit of human interaction. They want it to be humans there as a kind of trust factor.
And when it comes to that trust factor, are they aware of deep fakes? Is that part of the concern in terms of the news story being told online?
Yeah, no, it is. And it will continue to be, just like it, you know, there is also nervousness about what's around the corner with AI. I mean, I think for the news industry, it's slightly scary because, you know, with chatbot interfaces, people may never see a news website again. You know, they'll just sort of be asking questions and they'll be told what is the news. Right at the bottom of the page might be a link to a news website that might be correct or incorrect.
And the same report was discussed on Drive Time with a shudder down the spine of Sarah, who was talking to Maeve McTaggart.
Work actually as a multimedia reporter yourself at independent.ie. I wonder, were you surprised at these results?
To be honest, Sarah, I think I was mostly surprised that the rates weren't maybe higher for those who are using online news and social media. You know, I think amongst my age group in particular, maybe it's just my perspective, I'm 25, but I think it'd be very rare for people now to kind of actively switch on TV for their news or turn on the radio. You know, I do work for a newspaper, but I think to see someone of my age walking in to buy a newspaper would be incredibly rare. Mm. So I think those rates would probably definitely climb, I think, especially in the next few years.
You can understand why this might be a depressing conversation, Maeve, but we'll forge ahead.
Through gritted teeth. So where are you getting your news then, young people?
From your own perspective then. Sorry, do you mind me asking, what age are you? Did you mention your age?
25.
25. So do you watch, like you're a journalist, do you watch news on the TV or the radio? Do you listen to the news on the radio? Do you, I suppose you do probably buy newspapers, do you? Or do you?
I do. I think I'm in a kind of unique position as a journalist that I would be very conscious of, you know, where and how I'm consuming news. But I think I probably wouldn't have sat down to watch news on TV probably since about the times of COVID, around the times of those pandemic announcements. And I think the radio largely would kind of come on when I'd be in the car or at work. So I think predominantly it would be online news outlets that
So you listen to radio by accident,
towards.
By the sounds of that. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Oh, great.
Of course, the irony of discussing this on the radio isn't lost on anyone.
Last November, I was reporting on the initial stages of the Dublin riots. So, you know, I was filing copy, I was taking video, taking pictures. When I came home after work, I was really struck by the fact that I couldn't tell my friends anything that they didn't already know. You know, they'd watched the whole thing live from multiple angles, multiple vantage points through live streams on TikTok. Mm. You know, so that's where they are getting their information, because that's where the information is really quickly.
And
really,
I'm really interested in your view on that, right? So the Dublin riots being a particular event where, as you say, there's live streaming almost of what's going on at a moment in time. But when it comes to more complex issues, like, for example, the referendums that we had, where they were actually quite complex and the wording and the potential implications of all that, do you find that can be or that is being explained in platforms such as TikTok, if that's where people are getting their news? Are the complexity of the issues being explained on those platforms, or can they be?
I think it's difficult in terms of people aren't going on these platforms to find news. I think people are coming across the news accidentally sometimes, a lot of the time. So to find out news about the referendums, information about, you know, the elections last week, I think it's difficult because these platforms aren't designed to be news sellers. You know, they're not designed to be news outlets.
Yeah.
So I think it's difficult to, I suppose, give people information in the way they want. I think TikTok in particular is very casual, very kind of tongue-in-cheek, very relaxed. So at the same time, to be explaining very, probably quite complicated kind of constitutional questions in terms of the referendums or election candidates' positions, you know, it's I think it's difficult, but it's definitely something that has to be worked out.
But before you throw your hands in the air in despair, it is not all the devil's work.
It's based on kind of geolocations. So you can get very local news on TikTok because, you know, it knows where you are. If you're living in Clontarf, it can give you videos that are happening in Clontarf, you know. So I think it does work and people are able to learn a lot. I think it definitely broadens people's perspectives. You know, you're able to get 10 different people within the space of 15 seconds. You know, you just have to kind of catch their attention. So I suppose it's a matter of meeting people where they're at, I suppose, rather than attempting to change how they're consuming news, because it's going this direction anyway.
Yeah. Oh, it's really.
And there was more on the online life with author Katun Prisivka with Oliver. And just before we get into it, quick look down. Are you wearing ankle socks? That'll be important.
You're Gen Z, so you're literally born.
I'm a late millennial, and I'm the last of the millennials.
Oh, you squeeze in,
yeah,
do you?
Just about on the cusp, and I have older siblings, so that puts me in millennial category, but okay. I'm not cool enough to be Gen Z. I still wear ankle socks. The Gen Zers will be like,
right?
Will be like, oh yeah, okay.
Didn't even know that's a thing, but
it's
you're
a thing,
in.
It's a thing.
Making a mental note. Now, her second book is called This Is How You Remember It, and it is about growing up with the internet.
The novel starts with the child and there's the unboxing of the big computer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a lovely evocative stretch of innocence at the very start. So you're down at the beach as a family, go to the beach and so on. So it begins with the kind of the unboxing of this giant computer in the house and the innocent dabbling of the internet. we all start screaming when suddenly the search engine starts suggesting, filling in the words. Explain to us what's going on there in the poor child.
Well, there's a lot, I think, because for me, what I was thinking about my own internet experience was that the internet used to be a place. It used to be something that you sat down at and you could then leave. And then when I was thinking about the desktop computer and that being set up in one part of the house, normally in, you know, a communal room, people are coming and going. Completely different to the idea of having a smartphone, you know, or an iPad or something like that. It's very much anchored. So there's that. And I also kind of wanted to get across the idea that I think the internet has fundamentally changed as well. It used to be something that you dictated. You would say, you know, show me pictures of a unicorn. You would say, I want to go on a Harry Potter fan site. You would search, you know, mini clip games or something. And it would maybe correct your spelling on it, but it would show you what you were looking for. Mm-hmm. Now the internet tells you what you should be doing, you know, through algorithms.
That's a really good observation.
Like I no longer think, oh, maybe I'm going to get into crochet. My TikTok feed just says, hey, do you think you should do some crochet? Do you know? We've kind of ceded agency to some degree. And I think...
And they use a lovely word, suggestion.
Yeah.
So we're suggesting these things.
But I mean, you know, I think in the age of surveillance capitalism, Shoshana Zuboff calls it behavioral certainty. The idea that they know so much about you on a microscopic level that if they nudge you, you jump. And that's something they can sell to advertisers, which I think is not very good.
And while we might all be online a lot of the time, what we're viewing and how we're scrolling can be profoundly different. We give you Skibidi Toilet.
That was something that like blew my mind when I heard about it, because it is this meme that is popular only with the Generation Alpha, you know, who are 14 years and below. Okay. And it's like a head singing in a toilet. It's kind of bizarre stuff. But you look it up on YouTube. You think I'm joking. It's called Skibidi Toilet. You look it up. Thousands of videos, hundreds of millions of views.
It's a phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon. It's a global phenomenon that nobody over the age of 15 knows about.
God Lord.
Yeah, so people in your house, you're looking at the phone.
I didn't know about that until now.
Yeah, you're looking at your phone, you're looking at the screen, you're thinking, oh, well, sure, we're all on, I don't know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, all these same apps or whatever it is, but we're engaging with them in very different ways and becoming more and more divided, you know?
Rapidly Googling that one. But as for Prasivka, although she tells Oliver she did indeed beg for that smartphone, she is now pretty angry about the world she was allowed into.
I grew up with this narrative of like, just get off your phone, or, you know, seeing the, you know, addicted to social media young girl, isn't she vapid and whatever. But this isn't a world that I ever consented to live in. This isn't one that I've ever had any agency over. You know, I haven't created these apps. I'm making no money from these things. It's the generation above me and above that that is always
making the money.
If you're not
honest, you're actually not in the community of your peers.
You're not in the community. And that, and there are very good things about the internet. But I think we're moving more into this kind of profit-driven, scary sphere, as opposed to, you know, the community based kind of grassroots, sometimes anonymous sphere that the internet used to be, maybe in like the 2000s, you know. And I think I've had some funny reactions to the book, and that everyone kind of my generation and younger has said, this is so true, get out of my brain, I do remember it, oh my god. And everyone older than me is like, I'm terrified. Please tell me this is not what it's like. And, you know, I suppose the title is a bit accusatory. And in the beginning, it opens with, you do remember it, don't you? Why don't you? Because we all do. And if you don't remember it, but yet you facilitated a world where we were forced to live it.
Catherine Prasivka with Oliver. And then on Morning Ireland, news of a warning from the US Surgeon General that social media contributes to teen mental health difficulties. Professor Matthew Sadlier, chairman of the Consultants Committee, spoke to Cian and started by talking about that warning.
He issued a report last year in 2023 saying that, you know, that social media use by youth, and specifically excessive social media use, leads to an increase in depression and anxiety. Now, the reasons for this are multiple and quite complex, but ultimately it is an addictive type behaviour, and all addictive behaviours obviously play around with our reward pathways and our mood pathways. And the Surgeon General in his report last year said that the introduction of social media may have contributed to more than 300,000 new cases of depression among the university age population in the United States. As you know, this week he has called for a warning label and is basically is saying that we should be treating social media the same way we treat other addictive behaviours, such as smoking. And we will be saying that as the European headquarters of many of these companies, we should be imposing the same restrictions here.
Where would you put that social media warning?
Well, every time somebody logs onto the app, it comes up as a screen before they enter and it says, do you know you're entering into a dangerous space?
That's a warning. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Tuesday morning, just before 11.
Now, we're just seeing some breaking news. Eamon Ryan is to step down as leader of the Green Party. It's expected he will make...
And this coming only a few days after the results of the local and European elections. Immediate reaction from Fionnán Sheehan, Ireland editor of the Irish Independent.
Eamon Ryan told your own paper back in May that even if they lost those MEP seats, that he would not step down. What's happened?
Yeah, I suppose an accumulation of events. It wasn't a complete wipeout for the Green Party. Having said that, they won 49 local council seats in 2019. They've come back with 23 now, and between people leaving the whip and so on and so forth in the intervening years, about half of them gone. But then in the European side, losing both their seats. And also when you look at, although the votes were down, it was kind of the transfer toxicity of the Green Party that meant that their candidates couldn't get across the line. It was a trend that Eamon Ryan himself was noticing, talking to him in the RDS on Sunday, that seats that they were winning back in 2019, because they were transfer friendly, particularly on the left, they weren't falling their way this time because left-wing parties votes were not coming their way because they were now considered to be closer to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as a result of going into government. So you effectively get taxed by voters for going down that route. There had been some speculation that if things didn't go terribly well, Eamon Ryan will possibly stand down. But I mean, he is the party leader, of course, since their complete wipeout in 2011, built them back up from absolutely nothing through those dog days of 2011 to 2016, where they had no funding, no TDs, mm-hmm. only three councillors. So he can certainly say he has done his time, but inevitably this departure will be directly linked to the results in the local and European elections.
And as leader of the Green Party since 2011, Eamon Ryan drew praise from former Green Party councillor and environmentalist Sive O'Neill on Drive Time.
I'm very sad to see Eamon resign. I suppose it was going to happen eventually anyway, but his announcement today came as a surprise. And I say that because I think of Eamon as the outstanding political leader of our generation. I've worked alongside him in both in his Department of Climate Action, but also in the Department of Transport. And he has an extraordinary ability to combine strategy and vision. And also he has the negotiating skills and grasp of detail that are essential to drive the agenda forward.
And as tributes were paid in a playbook we know all too well at this stage, in the background, machinations afoot for a successor. Who would it be? But initially, of course, no one would be drawn. Least of all, Green Party Minister of State, Joe O'Brien.
Who's your preference?
I'm not going there today, Cormac. I think today is Eamon's day, and I think it genuinely it's actually a huge loss to Irish politics in general, because I think he's been...
And with Catherine Martin ruling herself out this time around anyway and stepping down as deputy leader, who was it to be? By Wednesday, two names were emerging. Minister Roderick O'Gorman, with 24 years in the party, and then junior minister, Senator Beef Farmer and Rural Box Sticker, Pippa Hackett. But do not forget, nominations don't officially close until Monday. So who knows? But on Wednesday, outgoing Green Party leader Eamon Ryan spoke to Clare.
What do you think now is of primary concern for the Green Party? Is it this pushback against the narrative, the anti-rural narrative, or is it winning seats in the next general election?
It's serving the people by steering the country in a greener direction. It's delivering practical changes that improve people's quality of life as we address the ecological crisis we face, and bringing social justice in the transition. That's our goal. That's our reason for being there, is to serve the people and to deliver a safer, more prosperous future. And that's the only metric.
In his resignation speech, Eamon Ryan had spoken about hostility online as an increasing feature of public life. But he also emphasised that it was not a decisive factor in his decision to step down. But what about those tweets and the rest from Ryanair's Michael O'Leary?
It became very personal. He called you a dunce. He called you an idiot. He said you were incompetent. Then when you made your announcement yesterday, I'm sure you saw this, the airline published that picture of you appearing to be asleep in the convention centre. Do you think you could have handled that relationship differently to avoid that happening?
No, I don't. Well, I mean, obviously I would defend my approach, but to be honest, I didn't respond to it. I've never made a personal comment about Michael O'Leary or Ryanair, and I think it doesn't reflect well on them if that's what they, the way they want to go. Let them speak for themselves. And I think my mind, that's not something I would follow or try and get engaged with.
Did it affect you?
I've been a subject of quite a bit of attack for quite a long time. I remember the very first time I ran for office back in 96, I think it was 97, I ran for the Shannon. And I remember about page 90 in some newspaper, there was one tiny comment about me, and I hardly slept for a week afterwards because I thought it was unfair. 30 years later, it doesn't really upset me. I mean, obviously, sometimes, occasionally, it gets very personal or very maybe about your family, then you'd be really upset. But no, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I've more important things to get on with. Yeah. And if you spent your time worrying about that, you wouldn't do your work.
You were here.
So, stepping down as leader and not running in the next general election. So,
what are you going to do?
I'm going to spend some more time at home, is with First Things, because I do have that responsibility. I'll continue to working in environmental and climate activism, but I'll do it in a way which allows that more balanced approach.
Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan. Now, nobody wants summer to end, particularly when maybe it hasn't even begun, and when the solstice comes early, well, you're going to make the news. Here is David Moore of Astronomy Ireland with Carol Coleman on Thursday. Yes, Thursday's News at 1, the 20th of the month.
The 21st of June is the date that we all associate with the longest day of the year. But this year, the summer solstice is early and today is actually the longest day of the year. Can you explain for listeners what this is all about?
Yes, indeed. Well, the first thing is to remember the Earth's going around the sun every year. And the year isn't an exact number of days. It's 365 and a quarter days long, roughly speaking. So we have to reset our calendar every 4 years with a leap day at the end of February. And that has the effect of resetting the exact moment when we reach the solstice, which, by the way, is the start of summer in the Northern Hemisphere. It's not June the 1st that the meteorologists would have you believe. It's always been an astronomical event, because what's happening is that the Earth's axis is tilted directly toward the sun, the closest it can get pointing toward the sun. In other words, somewhere on the Tropic of Cancer, the sun will be overhead, its most northerly point of the year. And that's what defines the seasons. It's the sun heating up the Northern Hemisphere that causes our summer. So we can argue with a meteorologist that today may or may not be summer, but we'll all agree that tomorrow is definitely summer. And this one's a bit of a record, because it's the earliest that has happened, June the 20th, at 9:50 p.m. tonight, since 1796.
228 years. Will we have to wait another 228 to see this happen again, this early solstice?
No, the record will be broken this time next year.
Ah,
so there, and take that, meteorological calendar, while we're at it. And on Poetry People, Night Feed by Yvan Boland, introduced and read by former master of our National Maternity Hospital, Dr. Rona Mahoney.
It's a really beautiful poem, and it reminds me so much of when my own babies were small, coming in the early morning to feed them. Dawn outside, and the magical feeling of being in a world of your own and just you and the baby. This is dawn. Believe me, this is your season, little daughter. The hour mercurial rainwater makes a mirror for sparrows. It's time we drowned our sorrows. I tiptoe in. I lift you up, wriggling in your rosy zipped sleeper. Yes, this is the hour for the early bird and me when finder is keeper. I cook the bottle, how you suckle. This is the best I can be, housewife to this nursery where you hold on, dear life. A silt of milk, the last suck, and now your eyes are open, birth-coloured and offended. Earth wakes, you go back to sleep, the feed is ended. Worms turn, stars go in, even the moon is losing face. Poplar still for dawn and we begin, the long fall from grace. I tuck you in.
Ah, night feed. Brilliantly capturing that late night feed of new babies and the early morning dawn of a new life.
From Poetry People. Over with the Darcy all week long at the top of the programme, he was bringing us a little moment of relaxation.
Take a breath, close your eyes, unless you're driving. Count to three.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful
world. Oh, lovely. And from the sublime to the ridiculous.
I was eating lunch on Cork's marina, tackles no less with Helena. I finish, get back in the car, the radio from somewhere far emits a voice, a kingdom lilt. Oh, my failed diet, I'm filled with guilt. Sinead has drones o'er the marina, announcing egg taco, less the Helena.
Brilliant!
That's
Jim.
Jim is great.
Some amount of work got into that.
He's fantastic. There you are now.
There you go. Taco leish na Helena.
Oh, that's kind of brilliant. Na Uilechán immortalised. With Oliver yesterday, Bláthnaid de Burca, a fan of sport, she is not.
Here's the thing though, right? Have you know the IT crowd? There's an episode where Roy, I believe, and he doesn't know how to they don't know how to enjoy football.
That's right, or talk
so,
about it.
Yeah, and so they get taught these phrases. So one is like, did you see that ludicrous display last night? And then the other one is, the problem with Arsenal is they always try and walk it in, right? And there was one time I was hanging out, years ago, I was hanging out with my boyfriend and he was saying that he was going to be watching the Arsenal match. And I went, oh, the problem with Arsenal is they always try to walk it in. And he goes, he looked at me, he goes, how do you know that?
That is like, brilliant.
Oh my God, okay, it applies. I'm an expert.
That is brilliant.
Now they had sent her off to look at the Spain-Italia match for Euro 2024. Pretty sure Spain won. But by the end of the match, she was kind of into it. Well, maybe for the amateur dramatics, if nothing else.
My issue as well always has been with soccer that, you know, they're trying to milk these injuries and stuff like that. Because, like, I mean, there's some of those I was like,
oh my gosh.
And that's the interesting thing is when I did get to, to focusing, I was like, oh, that. Oh,
oddly, mostly the Spanish last night, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Carvajal, he was rolling around.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's
slightly brushed against his split end, rolling around in agony.
That's it. But so some of it I was like, get over yourself. But then once I did get into it, I was surprised with myself there, where I was like, at one stage I exclaimed, yes, after a particularly good pass. I was like,
pass.
My God, that's my boy. So. Again, this is not me, but I'm coming away from this experience saying things like, oh, Spain absolutely dominated Italy. and I know that and I recognise that. So.
Game of two halves. No one's bigger than the team. Sportball. On Liveline, a problem. Admittedly, a first world problem, but a problem nevertheless. Assuming one was honest. And of course, Mary was.
Yesterday afternoon, okay. I just happened to open my boot of the car.
Yes.
And I discovered wine in my car.
Ah. How many bottles?
There were 12 bottles of white.
Wow.
And 2 bottles of red.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And when did you... Oh, you didn't buy them?
No, it ain't mine. No. I know it sounds very weird.
Yes.
But obviously, some poor, unfortunate person put it into my car by mistake.
Happy days, you might think, but no, because Mary wanted to give the wine back. But first, more details.
It was six bottles of Oyster Bay and 6 bottles of Villa Maria.
Oh, lovely.
And 2 bottles of red wine, which is Tesco's, their own Tesco wine.
Okay, Tesco's. And where are they now? The wine?
Pardon me?
Where's the wine now? Where, you haven't been at the wine, have you, Mary?
Pardon me?
You haven't been at the wine. Where are the 14 bottles now, Mary?
The 14 bottles are in my kitchen.
Are you sure? Was it your birthday recently, Mary? Did you?
No, no, my birthday is in December, though.
And did you win a race at the athletics championship in Rome or anything? Did you?
No, I didn't win anything.
And it was the receipt there. Was the receipt?
The receipt was in the box. Oh,
okay.
Yep.
And were you able to make out the time of purchase, Mary?
That's it. I'm just looking. Hold on a sec, Joe.
Okay,
I'm just,
will you?
16:06, 14:42.
That
should be 3:15.
3:15, 14:42.
Oh, he's on the case. Just who is this wine drinker with the penchant for the lady petrol?
Hello.
Florence.
I'm stepping forward feeling a right idiot because of putting the wine in the wrong boot. So I don't believe you.
So, Florence, what happened?
What happened was I live in Sandyford Road, and I drove to Stillorgan, where I often go.
Yes.
And I went into the big Tesco store, and I was a bit taken aback by the tiny little place where they have the wine.
Okay.
Not knowing there's another big store. Big awful affair. And I had read in the paper the day before there was a special offer on Villa Maria.
Oh, Villa Maria.
And Oyster Bay wine, white wine, Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
Yes, all the way.
And my daughter's like that. And then I put in 2 bottles of red for good measure.
Okay.
And I was not allowed to buy it because it was before 12:30 and I had to go out without it.
Okay.
I didn't know you didn't know
on
you could buy it.
On a Sunday,
I knew about 10:30. I just thought it was always 10:30 with buying alcohol. So I went off to a function in Stepaside Golf Course from 12:30 until
Florence,
maybe
not skimping on the detail. On it went.
I left the wine with her, went out the door, got a trolley with my special.
Florence, can you? I'm going to open a bottle of wine. You're taking so long telling this story. Go ahead.
And can't be honest. When I went back with the trolley, this lady helped me. She lifted the box and the trolley for me. Off we go down towards my car, and
there's
a double wing.
Yes.
Yeah, and then we got to off my mom's car, and I clicked it open, and she lifted in the wine carefully.
But how?
Then she said to me, "Wait till you hear. This is ending in a minute."
Okay.
She said to me, "Give me your trolley. I'll give you a euro." "Oh no," said I. "I want my token."
Yeah.
So back I go with the trolley and got my token, and we did chat. She had a 14-year-old.
We're going to cut to the chase. Was it her wine? Yes, it was. They even checked against the time code on the receipt.
Florence, one question. Did you hear all of what Mary said before you phoned us? Okay.
No,
so
I just want
to ask you a verification question. I don't doubt you, Florence. I don't doubt you. But there's a lot of chancers around, as you know. And you're not one of them. But can you tell me approximately what time you bought the wine on Sunday?
About 2:40.
Ah, bingo. 2:50. Bingo.
Case closed. And all is right with the world, at least on Dublin's south side anyway. You would think.
My only question is, it was a man got into the car. Is that Mary's son?
The plot thickens.
Sorry?
Mary.
No, my brother was with me.
Well done. Yeah, well done. Well, that's another verification from Florence.
And were you at the cinema? No, I wasn't. I was in across the road in Reba's having lunch.
Oh, lovely.
With my son and daughter-in-law and 2 delightful little grandchildren. Well, Terry, the security guy, said that it was... he told me a man got in. And 2 little kids, I saw them, but I didn't think 4 people got into the car.
Okay. Well, Florence and...
Let it go, Mary. Let it go. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Who's a fool in the corner crying? I say, a little old wine drink of me.